coming out on a Saturday morning. I know this is kind of an unusual time for a session. If I was in the same position, I'd be off hiking someplace, trying to get up into the snow. Or maybe it's a good thing for me that there's a little bit of a cold drizzle today. So this is a little special bonus session, as it were. Originally, I planned to do this on Thursday, but as many of you know, my mother broke her ankle, and so that kind of changed the schedule a little bit. So this session is meant to be part of the five presentations I was going to do on African Christians in Africa, whose faith influenced their involvement in politics in some fashion. So it's meant to, the sort of whole idea for this was to demonstrate, broadest terms, what is the relationship between religion and politics, and how should or can Christians participate in the kingdom of the world, as it were. What are Christians called to do? How much should we challenge the powers that be or speak truth to power? And how much does Jesus tell us, better? How much is his kingdom not of this world? And how much is Christianity primarily about the relationship between each individual and those around them and God? Or is Christianity also about power structures? Do Christian values, principles, beliefs have any place in politics or in how people govern themselves? So that's kind of this broader question. Then I guess the other thing I'm looking at African cases is raising the issue of, does Africa offer sort of special ways or distinctive ways to answer that question? Is there something about these various cultures in Africa which, in my opinion, are sort of less concerned about dividing secular and sacred? What impact does that have on the way African Christians see their place in their society? And what I find is that in the case of these five individuals, that they all feel that they are called by God to get involved in politics, to speak truth to power, to influence the formation of government policy, and even to overthrow governments or to challenge them. I mean, the one case I didn't have the opportunity to do this week was that of John Chilembwe, who in some respects is the most radical of these five cases, because he resorts to violence, unlike the other four. I won't get into that story. It's a separate story. But anyway, so now, with this case, Desmond Tutu, we're talking about South Africa, talking about the 20th century, and I thought, well, as interesting as Desmond Tutu is, I think to really understand his story, I guess being a historian, I feel we really need to look at the context. We can't, he has all kinds of agency and skills and accomplishments, I don't think those can be understood or even attributed to him alone without understanding the thousands of people around him who thought and acted similarly, that he was more a figurehead in their respects and an important one. Won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 and be recognized for his efforts to find a peaceful resolution to apartheid South Africa. But ultimately, what he learned in school as a little child and all the way from seminary and stuff was these ideas that he espoused and which he practiced, he was not alone in doing so. And so it's about Desmond Tutu, but it's more broadly speaking about what I call Anglo-African Christianity in South Africa. And by that I mean the influence of particularly British missionaries during the 19th century and then sort of British South Africans in the 20th century on the formation of a pretty distinctive way of thinking about politics and thinking about South African society, the role that British missionaries and what I'll call British liberalism had on this growing critique and challenge to apartheid in South Africa. And so that's, I guess, the thesis, if you will, of my presentation is that I think that South Africa, the end of apartheid in South Africa was very significantly influenced by Anglican Christianity, by Anglo-African Christianity, and that the beliefs of British missionaries originally, and then up through Black African sort of British Christians, if you will, played a central role in the formation of the African National Congress and the formation of all these groups that ultimately led to the overthrow of the apartheid regime. All right, so that's the idea here. And so I'll basically want to just show you, talk about several aspects of it, and then allow plenty of time for questions and conversation about it. The handout that I've given you, there's not enough for everybody, I'm sorry, if you can share that, it'd be helpful. Two quotes on there I'll make references to, but one is the Kairos document, 1985, when various church leaders in South Africa got together and formed a sort of this group statement critical of the apartheid government. The second excerpt is from Desmond Tutu's book, God is Not a Christian, which is available in the bookstore here at Holden, one of the ones that I recommended. It's basically an anthology of various speeches and essays by Desmond Tutu during the course of his career. And this is just one statement from there. And then the back side of the handout, you see a little rough outline of major events, questions to consider, and then some suggested books to read that illustrate some of this Anglo-African Christianity. All right, so I guess maybe, I don't want to do a whole big lecture on South Africa, but just so that, to make sure that we're all on the right starting page here, what do we even mean by apartheid? What is South African apartheid? And its literal translation just means, you know, apartness, as it were, separateness, segregation. It's basically the Afrikaans word for segregation. And within South Africa, one, I guess a couple points I want to emphasize. One, I think the tendency in the United States is to look at South Africa through the lens of our own history and society. And so when we saw, you know, separate drinking fountains for whites and blacks or separate accommodations for whites and blacks, immediately think American South, Jim Crow era. We think of segregation as it existed in the United States and what a travesty and injustice this was. But I think that's an inaccurate reading of South African society and history. It's a lot more complicated. They don't just have black and white, and blacks are the majority. I think in some respects, a more analogous, I mean, the experience of South African blacks, in many respects, is more analogous with that of Native Americans than it is with African Americans. The black South Africans were never enslaved. They were not torn away from their mother culture. They were defending their own land, and they were put on sort of the South African equivalent of reservations and denied access to power and wealth, expected to Europeanize. And there's all kinds of parallels with, and even chronologically, the same time, you know, cowboys and Indians were fighting each other in the United States, British and Zulu were fighting each other in South Africa. Similar kind of progression of colonialism and so on. The difference, obviously, between the two is that South African blacks remain the majority. And so that's the significant difference. So here, just to apartheid here, categories. So when these things are referenced, I'm talking about black, which actually doesn't become a commonly used term, really, until the apartheid era. Means all those people of African ancestry, and I don't want to get into too much, they call it Bantu speaking. There's a certain language family in Africa, Bantu, sort of like maybe like Germanic languages or Romance languages, so those people speaking this kind of related languages. And then these are dividing, you know, the sort of major ethnic categories among those in South Africa, the Nguni, which include the Zulu, Xhosa, Ndebele, and Swazi, the Sututswana, which includes Sututswana, Pedi, Venda, and Tsonga. I would say, although it's kind of a contentious topic, I would say there's really four languages or cultures there. Zulu and Xhosa are, you know, probably 80% mutually comprehensible, as are Sututswana and Pedi to each other. But that's another whole issue, the politics of language. Those are categories as white, those of European ancestry. In 1990, that was about 11.5%. And that, again, is not a cohesive single group. There are those who are of Afrikaner or Dutch background, which are the majority, and those who are British ancestry, speaking English. And then those who are categorized as Asian are all from South Asia, those who are primarily from India, some from Pakistan, 2.5%, most of whom arrived in South Africa during the late 19th century, initially as workers on sugarcane plantations, and then to serve the needs of that population. Then you had lawyers and doctors from India came, most prominently, you know, Mohandas Gandhi. For his first 20 years of his career, was a lawyer in South Africa. And then the fourth category, colored. And I think this is the one that kind of gives the most problems to Americans, because we colored, obviously, in the United States, was at one point, you know, a term used for African-American or Negro or whatever. But in South Africa, it has a whole different history and connotation. Basically, what it refers to is non-Europeans of what was once the Cape Colony, which is a big chunk of South Africa, that they had certain rights and privileges, that they had for much of the 19th century, the right to vote if they owned enough property, if they learned English and became Christian. But so colored was just basically, in a sense, the original sort of other to the European colonizers in the Cape Colony area. And so basically, it was anyone who was not African in the Cape Colony. And so with the Cape Colony, non-European in the Cape Colony. So it was just a blanket categorization for anyone who was non-European. And so that included Khoisan, who are Africans, but they're ethnically, and you could argue racially, distinct from the Bantu-speaking Africans. Those people who are the offspring of mixed race, you know, marriages, if you will, Khoi and Dutch, but also Malaysians. And this helps to illustrate what I mean by those who were from Southeast Asia, brought there by the Dutch East India Company as slaves or as servants or as workers on vineyards and whatnot. So all these people in the Cape Colony. And today the colored people, for the most part, because of the several centuries of under Dutch, you know, within Dutch society, Dutch is their first language, or I should say Afrikaans is their first language. So even though from the United States they're thinking, oh, these are all the colored, black, they're all part of the same thing, well, don't tell that to a colored person, because they're speaking Afrikaans at home, they're relating to culturally and philosophically more closely with Afrikaners than they are with English-speaking anybody. And so it's a much more complicated picture than simply black and white. So that's the setting. So now what's wrong with apartheid? Well, I'll get into all that. Obviously, I mean, it was getting back to my analogy of Native Americans, and that was the problem, is that the blacks, when the basic rationale behind apartheid, and this now leads me into British liberalism here, the basic rationale was that Africans, could gradually sort of acquire European civilization, could gradually sort of be equal members in this European-run society in South Africa, but it was expected to be a very gradual process, and that the assumption during the colonial era, I mean, apartheid is really a product of colonialism, because the colonizing Europeans generally would have rather excluded Africans from their settler colony. And that's how it's analogous with North America, the sense that the Africans, the black Africans, didn't belong in colonial society only temporarily. They could come as workers, or they might learn enough English and become Christianized to maybe be sort of partial members of society. The expectation was that Africans should continue to do their own African culture somewhere else in land reserved for them, and that their participation in the South African white-run economy and government would be very limited or eventually non-existent was the idea. So that was the idea. So, I mean, apartheid took a while to develop. It doesn't become official until 1948, but the basic sort of rationale behind it, the fundamental purpose was, and the unavoidable contradiction of it was, is that the white sort of minority in charge of South Africa was on the one hand saying, politically, culturally, socially, you are excluded from our South African, white-run South African society, you don't belong in these cities, this is white territory. But at the same time, in contradiction it, was the expectation that blacks would also be integral members of the economy. So on the one hand, they're excluding them on sort of cultural grounds, but including them on economic grounds, that they were essential labor in this colonial economy. And so that contradiction is unsustainable, and that ultimately is what makes apartheid unsustainable. But that was the rationale. So now, I guess before I jump into British missionaries and Anglo-African Christianity, any questions or comments? Yeah.
Do you think that Why God Is Not a Christian, the title and the content was influenced, speaking of British liberals, by Bertrand Russell's book, Why I Am Not a Christian?
Oh, I have no idea. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, which actually is a book that Jesus could have written, but.
Yeah, well, in that essay.
In some
ways. Yeah, that was the first essay of this book,
yeah.
And it's meant to kind of provoke the person browsing the shelves and what is it?
Okay.
But as he talks about it in that essay, actually Desmond Tutu talks about his work in sort of the World Council of Churches and sort of conferences with Buddhists and Muslims and so forth. I think that's where it arose. His own personal experiences with non-Christians. He realized in order to have any meaningful conversation, we need to rethink who has a claim on God and so.
Right.
Question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
How much was brutality a part of keeping the other races in line, like the things that went on in this country?
Well, brutality, initially, yeah, there would be some imprisonment, but it doesn't, the violence doesn't reach sort of epidemic proportions until 1960 and beyond. 1960 is sort of a turning point with the Sharpeville Massacre, when there's this non-violent protest against passbook laws, sort of restrictions on movement within South Africa, and the response to that non-violent protest, which was at the end of several months of this kind of thing, but kind of built up, and the police in Sharpeville responded by just shooting everyone, even though they're unarmed, and killed dozens of people, shot them in the back, and that was a turning point, because then the government basically said, okay, well, we're going to keep up this violence, and the response from the Africans was, okay, we're going to mobilize them to confront you then violently, and that actually simmered down during the late 60s and then kind of sparks up again in the mid-70s and simmers down. And then the 80s was a free-for-all. It was very violent on both sides, trying to just a confrontation that had to be resolved.
Okay.
but in sort of enforcing apartheid laws, I mean, there was some arrests, but it wasn't like villages were being exterminated and stuff. I mean, that happened in the initial conquest in the 19th century, you know, when chiefs were overthrown and so on. Not in the 20th century. There's another hand up here. Yeah.
Has much changed for the average African?
I would say no. I mean, there's a rapidly growing African middle class now, and primarily that's a result of all these sort of middle manager positions in the government ministries and schools, and sort of all these sort of white-collar jobs that were government-funded. Many of those had been held by Afrikaners, and they were replaced by Africans. So the widespread affirmative action program. So there is a significant number of Africans, black Africans, who are sort of, you know, are on that ladder now, moving up and buying the second car and thinking about putting in a swimming pool or whatever. But I'd say the vast majority of black Africans did not get those plum jobs and are as poor as ever, and in some cases even poorer. Because there's a sense in the part of the corporation and the government that, well, now we've got affirmative action, everything's on the road to, you know, justice and whatever. And so a similar thinking, I would say, in the U.S., the sense that, you know, the poor deserve to be poor kind of thing. Well, you failed, too bad kind of thing. No, I would say there's a lot of de facto apartheid still takes place.
Whites increasingly live in what kinds?
Sorry?
Whites increasingly, well-to-do whites working in large corporations, increasingly live in what kinds?
Oh, yeah, well, you have all kinds of monopolies, right?
So to speak.
Yeah, no, that's another result of this. Is the wall just got higher and barbed wire got electrified. And, all right, well then, so how does Christianity fit into this? Oh, yeah, I was just going to show you a map here, sorry. Illustrating some of this, put out by the South African government back in the 80s, and to illustrate several things about this, the fact that it's put up by the South African government. This is meant to show you the color by racial concentrations of 30% or more by a magisterial district. So trying to illustrate, for example, how 30% or more of the people living in the Cape Colony, former Cape Colony area, are classified as colored, and that's a reflection of that history. Indians are, you know, in this area here around Durban. Blacks, they've got here in this area, all the rural areas here. And then they leave this uncolored. This is the what they call the homeland, black homelands, which operated pretty much like reservations in the United States. And then the yellow areas, they basically said, are white. So they justify this. The key is that 30%. And so they're saying, okay, if at least 30% of the population is white, and if you don't read that little 30%, you think, oh, so the cities are European spaces, white-controlled areas, and that these are coloreds, and they, just looking at the expanse of territory, there must be a really important part of the population, even though it's just showed you are, you know, less than 5%, and so on. So that's an interesting kind of map to show you that there are, the concentrations vary across the countryside. But what's missing from that, really, is that blacks are the majority throughout, and that the cities, you know, they're the majority of the people, and so on.
It shows you how maps are political statements.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And this, yeah, the fact this is put together by the South African government was for an international audience to kind of demonstrate, see how multicultural a country is. The only way you can possibly manage this is with apartheid. Don't you see that the cities are European spaces? Where else can they live? Blah, blah, blah. And so you're right. I mean, it's that 30% is, you know, is meant to serve their interests. Yeah.
What's the status of Lesotho? Is that an independent nation?
It's an independent country, which gets into a different history. The skill and wisdom of the, I would say, the chief, the king of Lesotho, as well as the king of Swaziland, and the rulers of Botswana, basically they pitted the British against the Boers and managed to get British protection to keep them out of South Africa's grasp. And so they remain independent countries politically, but economically they're completely dependent on South Africa.
So this map is what decade?
1980s, I would say.
This is 1980s. So this is the way it is now.
Oh, so the most part, well,
census.
I would say the cities now are even, you wouldn't be able to color them yellow anymore. I mean, I would say the majority are certainly black.
Okay.
Even more so than before.
And I'm assuming all the
and the homelands have been
all the yellow homeland. Is any port situation, so the whites controlled.
It wasn't so much the ports, but as it was industry and commerce. And,
okay.
And then homelands have been abolished too. They're coming just
ignored. Okay.
Can you give us a reference? I know South Africa is huge, but like a comparison, how big is it?
All right, I didn't put my little walnut this time. Well, that's about, that's a good question. Maybe
Montana?
The size of...
Maybe two or three times the size of Texas.
Oh, it is.
Maybe twice the size of Texas. Yeah, I mean, if you drive from Cape Town to Joburg, actually just a month or two ago, I mean, it took me 2 days to drive really from Cape Town up to Botswana. Maybe 20 hours or so to drive from here up to Mobutu. That's a big country. Average sized African country. All right, so Anglo-African Christianity, I think it's interesting the role this plays. The British missionaries play initially, and then beyond that, African converts to sort of British Protestant denominations, because throughout this, starting in the Cape Colony and then partly into South Africa, modern South Africa, was this expectation on the part of British colonial government as well as British missionaries that, like I said, that, I mean, this kind of classic, what I call British liberalism, that Africans would sort of gradually adopt elements of Western civilization and become equal members of the society. And this was the rule under the British Cape Colony, that if somebody owned, regardless of racial background, you know, or ethnicity, if you owned enough property and were literate and were Christian, then you gain the right to vote and to be, you know, operate as an equal citizen of the Cape Colony. And so this, you know, goes back to sort of some of the Christian ideals of David Livingstone and other missionaries, because that was their expectation. They weren't, you know, they saw themselves as benevolent, you know, servants of Africans, that they were coming to not just bring them Christ, but also to bring them European civilization, that this was to the benefit of Africans. So I don't want to fault them for that, but how it operated was, I guess, the catch here in my mind was, okay, how much equality did they really get by adopting European civilization? So the thing is, you know, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, these British mission-educated Africans really had adopted this and embraced it and thought, okay, you know, we'd much rather have this than be sort of disenfranchised, exploited laborers with the Afrikaners. I mean, they definitely preferred the British vision for Southern Africa over the Afrikaner one, which was much more discriminatory, much more exploitative, and regarded as much more racist, and regarded Africans as inherently, you know, inferior, whereas the British seemed to allow for the possibility of equality. And so this then, you know, becomes part of the governing principle of the Cape Colony, and then of British colonization in general. Once kind of goes back and forth how much control the British have over Southern Africa, because there's the Anglo-Boer War in 1902 that complicates things, and Cecil Rhodes had his own vision of what should happen. Creates his own colonies, Rhodesia, you know, up north. But ultimately, it does play a role in the formation of these African groups of literate African elites, the school-educated, college-educated, and they become the leading voices in the African society. They publish newspapers in their own African languages. This gets into my next sort of research. I'm reading all these African language newspapers and trying to figure out how do they respond to sort of a increasing restrictiveness of British control. And while the British may have had this initial idea of, yes, we're going to allow Africans to be equal, in practice, there was a lot, there was a sort of a glass ceiling, as it were, a concrete ceiling of racism. But ultimately, I would argue that the British colonial authorities moved more in the direction of the Afrikaners. And there's a persistent racism in the sense that, well, you know, these Africans, even if they learn English and, you know, act and behave like good British, you know, citizens, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, they're fully European enough. And so I think the skin color continued to play an obstacle, play a role in hindering this. So to contrast this British view, oh, I think I got some more pictures here. Oh yeah, here's just to illustrate some of that. Shows you a picture of students at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, which is a prominent Anglican, well, it was a prep school and then a college in Grahamstown, early 20th century. But so is you, these African students, many of whom were the sons or nephews of chiefs, and were already prominent in their society, and here they were learning to, you know, read Plato and all the greats of English literature and Shakespeare, and then memorize Shakespeare's plays and translate them in their own languages, playing cricket here. So they had adopted this idea of what South Africa could be, sort of a British-style, multiracial society. And that shows you St. George's hanging in the cathedral today. This is where Desmond Tutu was archbishop situated. It just shows you a service there with all the incense going and everything. Actually, this last Easter I celebrated at St. George's, and it was kind of striking. I'd forgotten how, incense, a little incense is nice, but I personally overdid it. It was like gospel reading, where is he reading? All right, so then in contrast to this was the Afrikaner view, and it's important to recognize what Christianity meant in their vision of South Africa, because they saw Christianity very much as belonging to them. they were staunch members of the Dutch Reformed Church, and really saw their place in South Africa as the chosen people. That one time after another, they just thought that their success at settling and South Africa and the interior of South Africa and defeating the African hordes, that this was a sign that God had chosen them to rule this area. But they felt that these heathen savages were meant to either be laborers or killed off or pushed away. And it was just this classic kind of racism you get in the 19th century, but it persisted into the 20th century. As the Four Trekker Monument in Pretoria illustrates some of this sensibility, Four Trekker is basically the Afrikaans word for pioneers. And so the ones who took their covered wagon trains into the interior of Southern Africa and defeated the local Africans. And so there's a monument to the sacrifices they made in civilizing the interior of South Africa. Huge monument inside are the names and statues of all the leaders of these Afrikaner groups. And you can see here, circling the wagons. It's like it's part of the sculpture here. It's the lager, which is the name for this kind of fortified encampment. And it was like just a... So people talk about, critics or scholars on sort of trying to understand Afrikaners talk about the lager mentality, this idea of circling the wagons, this idea that you're a beleaguered minority. There's all these Africans around you waiting with their spears to kill you or to rape your women or whatever. There's all this, basically, I would say, built on fear anything else. And so this was obviously clearly contrast to British liberalism. And so you have these two kind of strands of what does Christianity mean? Is it kind of this open acceptance of everyone, or is it more tied to ethnicity? And so clearly the Afrikaners felt that.
When was this built?
I think it was in the 1940s. I can't remember. Or 30s.
And it's still accepted in South Africa? Or
the Four Trekker Monument?
They consider it a big joke nowadays?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. If you visit there, it's going to be all Afrikaner tourists. And a few Japanese and Chinese taking pictures, but you won't find very many black Africans there, other than mowing the lawn. all right, so that's Calvinism and predetermination. Oh, then I should say circling the wagons, and this brings it chronologically. Once apartheid is instituted in 1948, the threat, as the Afrikaners see it, to their lager is no longer sort of heathen Africans, but communists. Because what's happening then during the Cold War is that increasingly these African neighboring countries in Africa that are fighting for independence from their other colonial rulers are turning to socialist-leaning governments for support. I'm sorry to say, the United States was generally supporting the dictators, not the ones trying to overthrow them. So in Angola, Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, et cetera, what you have there are these rebel groups funded and armed by the Chinese and the Soviet Union. And the Cubans come in for a while. Che Guevara spends about a month in the Congo. And so the Afrikaners see themselves not just as this kind of white minority kind of holding out the last preserve of civilization, but also as the last preserve of democracy or Western civilization against communism. And this is how they see themselves and convince the U.S. and British and Israeli governments that this is in fact their role, that they are this outstation of Western democracy and Christianity, and they need all the help they can get in fighting off these socialist, communist rebels on the horizon. And so that also serves as, if you read the speeches during the 1950s and 60s by Afrikaner leaders, that's one of the primary ways they justify apartheid, is a bulwark, a defense against communism. That to give in to these anti-apartheid activists is to allow the country to fall into the hand of communists and to give up all of the freedoms that they enjoyed.
They even threw out British archaeologists in the late 60s, the Afrikaners did, who were too friendly with blacks.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, this is it. Yeah, once after Charcot Massacre, that's anyone who sticks, you know, scholars, any kind of artists, there's this steady stream of exiles from South Africa when they feel they can't operate underneath this apartheid government that gets increasingly authoritarian and violent. And so now, so how do Christians respond to this? Well, this kind of strain of British liberalism continues, but I'm pretty, you know, I guess looking at the end result, one can still be critical of it. I guess first to pause here, and when I was talking with somebody else familiar with the book Cry of the Beloved Country, mm-hmm. Alan Payton. Yeah. I mean, it's a classic novel, a very beautiful kind of lyrical vision of South Africa. It was written the same time apartheid started in 1948, well, it was 47 or 49. It was right in that same time period. But maybe you can share what, if you remember reading it, what is its sort of take on South Africa's situation? Or
the father has to go and work in the mine, doesn't he? Isn't he working in a mine?
Well, it's about an Anglican priest, a Zulu Anglican priest, African priest, who goes looking for his son, who's gone up into the big bad city of Johannesburg. And he goes after him to kind of, because he's been arrested, and so he's going to find him. And also, one of his sisters had gone earlier seeking her fortune and had become a prostitute. So it's about this Zulu Anglican priest, and Alan Payton himself was a staunch sort of British liberalist, I would say. So Africans going to the city, being corrupted by the city. The only sort of white heroes in it are Anglo South Africans who have like sort of run these welfare programs or boys clubs like that. And one of the tragedies is the son of this priest, in a botched robbery, a home invasion, kills the son of the farm owner back at their village in Zululand. But this son of the farm owner, the older guy, was pretty racist, the son was very altruistic. He was running his boys club, trying to help out sort of unemployed and homeless black young men in Johannesburg, and here he becomes the victim of black thieves breaking into his house. So there's all kinds of tragedy here, you know, with the black priest and the black white landowner trying to come to grips with whatever their son's done and who's at fault here. But I guess the reason I say it's sort of a classic expression of British liberalism is there's no hint or expectation that blacks are going to like overthrow the government. It's, you know, I don't know how to phrase it in my notes. I mean that the best remedy here, I think, argued by the British Anglican priests and so forth, but early apartheid era, is basically welfare programs, charity. So again, holding to this hope that you can sort of gradually elevate Africans, that the best response to apartheid is, you know, not to resort to violence, but to try and guilt the Afrikaners into modifying the laws, to try and make it at least a little more equitable, but to sort of, you know, a gradualist approach, but that Africans can best be helped by Europeans. There's very little in the book about Africans taking control of that boys' club and running themselves, or about taking control of land and redistributing the wealth as they see fit. It's about what can Europeans do for Africans? Mm-hmm. How can they make their situation more comfortable? How can they make their path to progress easier to walk down? And so, you know, I guess it depends on how you feel. Clearly, I think their motives were in the right place. But one could also criticize it as being very paternalistic. There was still an expectation that the purveyors of this charity were in charge. I mean, they're the ones deciding who gets what and who has deserved sort of to rise above this. And so even the most sort of radical character in there, a young black Anglican priest played by Sidney Poitier in his first movie, there's limits to him. I mean, he's critical, he's angry, but he doesn't go so far as to, you know, advocate things that Nelson Mandela and others would be advocating, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. He's just more critical. He's frustrated by the situation, but not really, you know, explicitly calling for revolution or challenging the status quo. So that's the situation, you know, in the 1940s. But what eventually emerges then is, as the government becomes increasingly repressive, both black and white sort of Anglo-African community becomes increasingly vocal in their criticism of apartheid. And that's what this Kairos document comes in. 1985 is a good sort of articulation of that, you know, as the quote on the thing comes here, and it also the reason it also speaks to the Afrikaner view of God. I'm just kind of reading it out loud here. You know, the state in its oppression of the people makes use again and again of the name of God. Military chaplains use it to encourage South African defense forces. Police chaplains use it to strengthen policemen. And cabinet ministers use it in their propaganda speeches. Again, illustrating my general point in all my sessions that religion is at the center of politics in most of Africa. But perhaps the most revealing of all is the blasphemous use of God's holy name in the preamble to the new apartheid constitution. In 1984-85, in response to all this criticism, the apartheid government basically tried to reform apartheid. They got rid of a lot of this kind of petty segregation stuff, and they allowed coloreds and Asians to participate in a sort of a separate parliament, but still they continue to exclude blacks. And they're trying to divide the opposition, basically. So, okay, if we allow some people to participate in government and we end this kind of petty apartheid, so they drafted a new constitution, which clearly, critics of the government didn't feel was enough. So yeah, so they quote from the Constitution. In humble submission to Almighty God, who controls the destinies of nations and the history of peoples, who gathered our forebears together from many lands and gave them their own, who had guided them from generation to generation, who has wonderfully delivered them, etc., etc. This God is an idol, let's say. It is as mischievous, sinister, and evil as any of the idols that the prophets of Israel had contended with. Here we have a God who is historically on the side of the white settlers, who dispossesses black people of their land, and who gives the major part of the land to his so-called chosen people. So clearly they felt that God was on the side of blacks, and not on the side of the white minority on the Afrikaners. And this really becomes then, and Desmond Tutu in the book God is a Christian has several essays on this, what he called, the whole section already called Black Theology, similar to liberation theology, but very specific, to the context of South Africa and Africa in general. And that's where he then, quote, read this out loud. But that's really what happens is during the 1970s and 1980s, 1976, there's this big uprising instigated by high school students in Soweto, but some of the main leaders of it are actually college students who've been part of this sort of I'm not trying to think what U.S. comparison would be. I mean, it's like a college Christian student group that had branches in each campus. And so while initially the idea was Bible studies, at the same time they're thinking about, okay, what does it mean to be black in South Africa? And they really become then the developers of this idea of black consciousness, influenced to some extent by black power in the U.S. But anyways, I think I could give lots of examples of how sort of the anti-apartheid movement continues to be grounded in many respects in Anglo-African Christianity. There's a number of sort of leading priests who play roles in this. I share those with somebody else. Some of my personal exposure to this, when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Botswana, it was November 85 to December of 87, at the height of this anti-apartheid violence and repression. I mean, I was in the country next door, but still it had an impact. And I traveled in South Africa and witnessed some of this and met people who had been tortured in prison and so forth. But one of the most striking things was in the village next down the road from mine, there was an Anglican priest from New Zealand named John Osmers. And when he'd been in Lesotho in the early 80s, he'd sympathized with the goals of the ANC and allowed them to hold meetings in the church basement and so on. Well, one day he received a package, opened it up, it blew up, and he tore off his right hand and almost lost a leg. But when I met him, he was still in Southern Africa. And this was a few years later, but he had a stump now and kind of healed. But he was living in Botswana and continuing to serve as a minister in a congregation, an Anglican congregation, but also serving as a halfway house for ANC activists as they fled South Africa to get up to Zambia or wherever. So it's just really interesting to hear him talk about the role of Christianity in the anti-apartheid movement, and he was completely committed to it and clearly willing to lay down his life for it, and felt that violence perhaps sometimes was justified, although he himself didn't own a gun or anything. But still it was, for me, as a young, impressionable, 22-year-old, when I'd go and have these long conversations with him, and before he'd give me a ride to the bus station, before he'd start his pickup truck, he'd say, well, don't get in the truck just yet. in fear of a bomb. Which did happen. I mean, we in Botswana, South African commandos would come over once in a while in helicopters, in their outfits and trying to assassinate ANC sympathizers. So he had reason to fear this happening. So this is the kind of situation that continues up then through the 1990s. I'm going to show you now a little video. I think I told 12, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is, I think, a good illustration of this. It's the song, In Cosa Si Che Lei Africa, which was first composed in the 1890s, the right spot. That is just a Xhosa language hymn, meaning God bless Africa. Let me just say a word about it. So initially, it was just sung in churches. It was just something that sort of black South African Anglicans would sing. Or actually, he was Methodist, but it's still British denomination. What's interesting is a very kind of soulful, mournful song. But in the context of apartheid, after Sharpeville, there's this growing sense among blacks that, okay, what can we do to fight against this oppressive system? Violence hasn't worked. We don't have the means to overthrow it. And so they turned to kind of looked at God, looking for comfort, looking for just courage to endure this injustice. And so then eventually this Nkosi Sikelel becomes more of an anthem, a political anthem. Even though the words are, God bless Africa, the feeling that that stirred in people who sang it was more like, okay, we're all in this together. That God is on our side, regardless of what these Afrikaners are saying, regardless of our sort of defeats along the way, we will triumph eventually, someday we have to, that justice and God is on our side. So that's the kind of song I'm going to just show you. This is from a documentary that came out maybe 10 years ago, which I recommend, called Amandla, a Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. It just shows you, it's really well done. I think it won several awards about the role of music in the anti-apartheid movement. So it goes through all the songs. So I'm just going to play 2 minutes of where they talk about it's in the right spot. It'll come up in a minute. Finishing one
music
second.
Was actually was not even what we call liberation music, but it was part of liberating ourselves. And you would know that it was a sign of protest. And everybody would feel very great just by listening to them.
Back to computer now. Is that one more picture?
It's
oh. Search.
Thanks, David.
So then I guess running short on time.
There's not a lot else we're going today.
Okay. Well, just
take your time.
To conclude with, yeah, so the current South African national anthem, it's pretty interesting because what they've done is they've taken the Nkosi Sikelel, which in three different languages, the first two lines are in Xhosa, the next two are in Zulu, which is very similar to Xhosa. And the next verse is in Sotho, well, they call Sotho Tswana. They say it's the Sotho, I would say it's more Setswana. Anyways, just it's a matter of spelling. And then what they do is the Afrikaners had their own anthem, which is a completely different sort of this, I would say, sort of a bombastic, sort of militaristic European song, sounding song. So it's a little bit jarring because you switch from this sort of African harmonies into, okay, a verse in Afrikaans with the ringing out from our blue heavens. And then you conclude with an English verse of basically this European sounding song. So it's, I think, a good illustration of, you know, just getting back to the title of the presentation. I'm trying to create a rainbow nation, which includes not people of different skin color, but also different ethnic groups, and trying to forge it into a united society. I guess I would argue that Christianity continues to play a role in that vision, the sense that, you know, if God is greater than all of us, perhaps, you know, in submitting to God's authority, we can somehow forge a united society. But I've sort of run out of, I mean, a big part of that was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is where Desmond Tutu plays a more important role. Was after apartheid officially ends in between 1990 and 1994, part of the resolution of that is to create this commission, which is a little bit bizarre to think about it. I mean, argue it's sort of like national group therapy. This idea that they create these kind of three subcommittees as part of this commission. One is just going to collect testimony. Anyone who feels that they are wronged by the police or by anybody who suffered for their political views, they come and they would just share this testimony, and people would record it and make this record of anyone who felt that they had been hurt under apartheid, during the apartheid era, and during the transition, had been the victims of political violence. And the second subcommittee would listen to people who had committed those acts of political violence. And so it was an opportunity for them to get granted amnesty. But the catch was, is one, it had to be politically motivated, and two, they have to disclose everything they did. And so, but the idea was that if you were some police officer who'd assassinated all these people and you came forward and, you know, in detail described all those assassinations, then theoretically you'd be granted amnesty. And then the third subcommittee was meant to sort of figure out reparations, restitution. You know, was there anything that the state could do to compensate people for their losses and so on. So it was kind of a bizarre thing because then you had these televised hearings where, you know, these members of the South African police would come on and describe all these gruesome atrocities, and with the, you know, the mothers of the slain young men sitting there listening to this and weeping. And so it was very cathartic, you could argue, but critics today wonder, okay, how useful was this? Because it wasn't meant to institute justice. There was no one was imprisoned as a result of the hearings. They produced five volumes of documentation of all work the committees did. But Desmond Tutu throughout was the chair of the TRC, and he wrote a whole book on this, or maybe several books, advocating what he called restorative justice rather than retributive justice. This idea that South Africa could not possibly go on and build itself again if it has this unending cycle of violence, of retribution, of people getting back at other people. And so he said, we gotta get over it. We can't, you know, we have to listen to one another's concerns and pain, and then just move on. You know, somehow.
Did it really work?
Well, for some people it did. I think there's still debate over that. I think in some respects I think it did. I mean, you didn't have wide scale sort of calls for people's heads and so forth. There was a lot of Afrikaners who had been sort of complicit in this did in fact leave the country out of fear that they might be retribution. But quite a few stayed and benefited from the TRC. But that's another, I could spend a whole session just in the TRC, because actually the vast majority of the people who came forward to seeking amnesty were actually black policemen. It wasn't whites. There was only a few. The vast majority were Africans, blacks, who had been agents of apartheid, I mean, who had been working for the government, and basically wanted to seek, you know, forgiveness from their own communities, because they realized, okay, now that apartheid's ended, I don't have a white government to back me up if I'm going to live in this society and not, you know, how do I live with my African, black African neighbors, then knowing that I was a former policeman and was responsible for this. So that was, most of the TRC was about that, about blacks trying to make peace with other blacks.
Yeah. I can see a couple of things there. One is it's really a form of confession, which would be good for people. And the other is going to be harder than hell to make deniability in the future and say, this didn't really happen. You know, the stories we heard, you got the testimony of thousands of people.
Oh, yeah, because the testimony was vital, especially when you had policemen, because they could say, well, no, we did, like, there was one famous case where they killed a bunch of young men who were activists, and then they planted weapons on them, you know, to make it look like they were terrorists, as it were. And so all you had, if you just had one policeman says, well, no, that's not how, you know, this is what we did, we were, you know, did this. Then the other policemen have nothing to stand on, and so then they have to come and testify. So I think in that respect, it did, it helped to, you know, shed light on a lot of nasty business, which obviously provokes a lot of anger then, but at the same time, I think it was a little cathartic. But it was, I think it's striking how Christian it was. And I mean, a lot of the critics thought it was too Christian. I mean, the language used by Desmond Tutu, I mean, he was encouraging these confrontations between police officers and the mothers, and he's seeking forgiveness, and they're wondering, okay, can I forgive you? And the language the women then would use and say, well, as a Christian, yeah, I guess I feel I can forgive you. I mean, it's just really heartrending and moving moments in this commission. But I would argue, you know, the principles upon which it was based and what made it operate were, you know, at the insistence of Desmond Tutu were very Christian in the language used and in this kind of irrational, if you will, expectation that justice can best be served not by incarceration and retribution, but just by moving on. Yeah.
It's funny, in our culture, that scene is irrational and kind of extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the norm.
Oh, a norm in...
That should be the norm.
Should be the norm.
Well, maybe the one historical lesson that was learned culturally among whites, Europeans, was the lesson of World War I. We put heavy retributions on people.
Oh, right.
And then it leads almost, you know, pretty immediately to the start of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least that lesson was taken and learned.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to apply it as best possible.
Yeah, but the other question in my mind is raised is, would this work in South Africa? I mean, about 80% of South Africa's population identifies as Christian. Would this work if you had less church-going people or people who are not as familiar with sort of Christ's message of forgiveness? Whether they would see this as a viable option to forgive and move on.
Could
it? Yeah. Well, I guess along those lines, I mean, on the bottom of the hand at the bottom, on the back side, a couple of books. Well, I mentioned Cry the Love of the Country. And then this is actually a doctoral dissertation, which was published in 2009 as a book that I think deals directly with this question. Religion and conflict resolution, and then it's all about the TRC and the role of Christianity in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Which, if you want to read in more greater detail about, you know, analyzing this question of what role, if any, did Christianity play in sort of South Africa's relatively peaceful transition? That's what she talks about in Tutu's book. And they actually sort of made a whole video. I think it might be available online, but you know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu of the Rainbow Nation basically talks about what I've been talking about, but focusing on Tutu's activities and thoughts. Today I'll just conclude. I think I have an audio file of their national anthem. Sorry, you can't hear it in my little speakers. Forgot about that. Yeah. Sorry, I have speakers in my room.
Oh.
I thought about this. That's already up to the max.
Government, I mean, to a lot of, to such a huge extent. extent politicians can't control even, you know, the economy and the economics that follow. And then they find themselves in after a revolution of any sort. That was, do you think that plays a huge role?
Oh, what, economic
changes?
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. Leaders, some have magic laws.
Oh, right. Who's calling the shots here? I mean, you can have all the ideas, best ideas in the world.
They're part of the world economy.
Right. No, I think that's simply what Sondheim was confronting that.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Initially, they wanted to redistribute the wealth on a massive scale, but ultimately, international investors were like, no, we're not going to let you do that.
Yeah.
So they backtracked and took a much more conservative.
We had done this after the Civil War.
Like initial sort of good good intention.
In this country, it's been a whole different picture for the last 100 years.
Right, all those amendments were pretty much ignored for a long time.
Interesting, when Jimmy Carter used that word hard time, he was talking about Israel and Palestine.
That's another whole issue.
Vehemence. How could you say that's a hard time?
Oh, right, right.
And said that, but Christians saying that. And the situation in Israel and Palestine being supported by conservative Christians. There's a lot of parallels.
Yeah, that's. I've had discussions with other people with differences of opinion on that. Argue there's more similarities than people might
think. Want to believe.
Well, that was the national anthem, if you heard it whispering.